Every dating app swipe is another loss. Gym bros, fake CEOs, straight up losers. So now the only app I open is Modo Casino, because at least there I'm surrounded by winners, real winners, thousands of them. While everyone else is in the single swamp, I'm at home relaxing while stacking bonuses, hitting wins, and playing all my favorite Vegas style games. Modo Casino, the only app worth your time.
Modo Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Modo.us for more details. Download the Modo Casino app today. Must be 21 plus.
Modo Casino, America's social casino.
When you start talking about the CIA, it's common to get these awkward sideways glances of concern, and I've been doing it long enough to verify that this is just the way it is generally. And it's not necessarily concern for like what the agency has done or what it might be capable of doing, but it's concern about you and about whether you've spent too much time staring into some strange corner of the internet, so you finally lost your mind. It's a concern that you're going cuckoo and you are a conspiracy theorist. But I have discovered over and over again that it's almost impossible to have a realistic conversation about the CIA, because some of the things that have been openly admitted to are so bizarre that just repeating them makes you sound insane. There are things hidden inside declassified government records that would sound absolutely ridiculous coming from the mouth of a conspiracy theorist, but they are still things that actually happened. There's experiments with consciousness, there's behavioral manipulation and bizarre psychological warfare techniques, there's manufactured realities, and apparently vampires. Because I discovered, buried in material released through the CIA, this strange account describing American psychological warfare personnel manufacturing the physical evidence of what appeared to be a vampire attack. I'm not speaking metaphorically here. According to the account, they killed this man, they punctured his neck, they hung him upside down, they drained the blood from his body, and then they placed the corpse where his comrades would find it. That's pretty crazy. That's a pretty wild thing for the Central Intelligence Agency to do. And the purpose was obviously obvious and simple. They wanted the enemy to believe that a monster had killed this guy. And perhaps the most disturbing part of the entire story is that the monster didn't even actually have to exist, because the fear already did. All the CIA had to do was give that fear a body. Now, there's a pretty important lesson in here, not only when it comes to the lengths that the CIA will go to prey upon a person's sort of primal and unexpected fears in things like monsters, but also the particular susceptibility that people who believe in monsters are subject to when it comes to these intelligence agencies that want nothing more than to basically figure out how to control you and how to defeat you in psychological warfare. So what's up, everybody? Welcome back to the 21CD podcast. As always, I am your ghost, John. I am an ex-member of the intelligence community, where I served as an interrogator, and I'm very excited to get into the time that the CIA used the Aswang, which is what they call the vampire in the Philippines, against their enemies, as well as some creepier story that I found, which we'll get into after that. Stay till the end to hear some very creepy sounds that the CIA used when they bizarrely attempted to convince the enemy in Vietnam that ghosts were real and essentially calling for them, telling them to surrender and trying to freak them out so badly that they just laid down their weapons. It's a very crazy little story, but like I said, yet another example of how the agency will go to bizarre lengths to win their battles and their wars. And that includes weaponizing your spiritual beliefs, beliefs in cryptids and monsters and spirits, so that they secure the bag. Okay, let's get going. There are more than 7,000 islands that make up the Philippines, containing an enormous variety of languages, customs, traditions, and religious beliefs. But among the creatures that survive centuries of colonization and cultural change is this monster called the Aswang. And calling the Aswang a simple vampire, admittedly, doesn't really capture what exactly it is, because there isn't necessarily a perfect Western equivalent for it. Depending on the region and tradition, the creature can resemble a vampire as you might think of one, or a witch, or a ghoul, or some sort of transforming predator. It's been described as feeding not only on blood, but also on organs and unborn children and other human matter, and it can allegedly take the form of animals, including enormous pigs, dogs, or strange birds. Now, other versions describe a humanoid-looking creature lurking on rooftops at night, lowering a long tongue through openings in the ceiling to feed upon the people sleeping beneath it. Pregnant women and children are particularly vulnerable in some versions of the folklore. Sudden sickness and miscarriage, unexplained death, and terrible luck or misfortune could also all be attributed to this creature. Spanish friar Juan de Plasencia was already writing about similar beliefs to this in 1589, describing something called an Aswang, which he equated with a sorcerer and said was believed capable of flying and murdering people and eating human flesh. This was a very old mythology. Oftentimes in these sort of ancient times, and in some regions even today, the types of beliefs that revolve around, you know, death and bad luck and sickness and all this kind of stuff, a lot of times it's attributed to witchcraft. Now, a psychological warfare legend named Edward Lansdale arrived in the Philippines in 1950 during the fight against the communist-led Hook insurgency, and he apparently understood something about not only psychological warfare, but also preying upon a person's psychology revolving specifically around their spirituality that conventional military thinking just didn't get at the time and often overlooked at the time. Who knows how often the military thinks in these ways now? Probably borderline often, to be honest with you, especially in agencies, because they've seen the success of these types of endeavors. But he realized that you don't really need to invent a new fear. Sometimes the most effective fear is already there. You just have to learn how to work it. You just got to learn how to manipulate it. You just got to learn how to flesh it out. And Lansdale himself wrote, "My orders were plain. The United States government wanted me to give all help feasible to the Philippine government in stopping the attempt by the communist-led Hooks to overthrow that government by force." But then he said something far more interesting. He said, "Conventional military men think of combat psi war, which is psychological warfare, almost exclusively in terms of leaflets or broadcasts appealing to the enemy to surrender." Lansdale, though, believed that psychological warfare had a much wider potential, and this is where things get kind of dark, because according to his account, his people began studying the mythology of the population around the insurgents. They started studying their folklore, their taboos, their superstitions, and their monsters. Essentially, they were conducting a form of cultural reconnaissance. They weren't just trying to figure out where the enemy was sleeping, what kind of guns they had, etc. You know, where they received their supplies or where their caches were hidden. They were asking what the enemy feared when they were in a spiritual moment, when the lights went out. They were asking what kind of monsters were under the enemy's bed and in their closets, if you will. And just a quick diversion here, but when I was going through interrogation training, we were trained in this type of stuff too, because you don't always just want to know where the enemy is. Sometimes you already know where the enemy is, but it's expensive to get to them. It's expensive to take them out, if you will. It's expensive to defeat them in battle. And so you have to use psychological warfare on them to get them to surrender, essentially, or to break apart their group, their cohesion. And a lot of that involves finding the weakest link. And specifically when it comes to interrogation, you are highly encouraged and required, essentially, to figure out your sources, and this isn't always a willing source, but your sources' fears, your sources' emotional triggers, your sources' goals in life and what they're concerned about, and essentially as much information as you possibly can about that source so that you can get in their head, okay? Sometimes it's as simple as a bag of Skittles. Other times, you have to invent vampires. And I'm obviously not saying that vampires are invented. If you've watched any of my videos, then you pretty much know that I firmly believe that vampires and vampiric humanoids are most definitely real. But sometimes you have to put them where they maybe are not, or use them in the environment that they are well known so that you can accomplish a mission. Apparently. I mean, hey, I'm just reading the document here. The principal source for all of this is Edward Lansdale himself. He described it years later in his memoir, In the Midst of Wars, and this was also in a CIA document that's been released to the public. This is important because it's not some fringe theory. It's actually written about, it's actually a part of CIA lore. And the broader American and Philippine use of psychological warfare against the Hook insurgency is pretty well documented. The Hooks, or the Hook Balahap, they were originally an organization created to fight the Japanese occupation. And by the early 1950s, the Hooks had become an armed communist insurgency operating largely through the countryside of central Luzon. And they were pretty formidable. And this movement was not just a simple collection of mysterious communist bandits that appeared out of nowhere. Its strength was largely tied to very real rural grievances involving land ownership and poverty and political corruption and the treatment of peasants, and they were a formidable group. The U.S. viewed this whole movement through the increasingly global framework of the Cold War and became deeply involved in helping the Philippine government inevitably in defeating it. And they did this in part through using Lansdale's bizarre approaches, who, fun fact, by the way, was actually working in advertising before he began intelligence work. And that background seems almost absurdly appropriate when you understand his philosophy, because he was intensely interested in how people interpreted events. He believed that defeating an insurgent didn't necessarily require destroying them physically. Sometimes it was just enough to alter the world that the insurgent believed he was living inside. And this is where the Aswang enters the story. According to Lansdale, a Hook squadron had occupied a hill near a village, and local leaders complained that the guerrillas were threatening influential villagers who refused to cooperate with them. And it was like 300 or 400 guys. simply assaulting the hill was one possibility, but it did carry those normal dangers of counterinsurgency warfare, which is very dirty, difficult warfare. And government troops would inevitably, undoubtedly suffer massive casualties by choosing this route. Civilians could also become caught in the fighting, and the guerrillas could just also retreat into the surrounding countryside and return later. Such is insurgency warfare. It is nearly impossible to win. So instead, Lansdale's people attempted something far stranger. And by the way, nearly impossible to win because so often you can't tell who an insurgent is. And so often you can't tell who this type of individual is. One day they are this thing, the next day they are another thing. You know, you kill some of their goats and now you've got another one. And you know, then you got to fight that one and then you get rid of that one. And now his kids are insurgents. And it's just like, it's like that. It's like a mentality, you know? And so it's very, very hard to defeat. Lansdale kind of knew this.
Moro Casino. America's social casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends. With thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
And instead, they decided to make the hill itself a frightening place to be to uproot the hooks. So the psychological warfare team began quietly introducing a story into the surrounding villages. That story was that an Oswang had inhabited the hill. It had taken residence on this hill. The Oswang occupies this enormous place in Philippine folklore, as I kind of already touched on, but describing it simply as a Filipino vampire doesn't really capture what the word means, because again, it kind of depends on the region or tradition that it's being interpreted in, but Oswang can describe all sorts of different predatory supernatural beings, whether they're shapeshifters or witches or flesh eaters or blood drinkers or creatures capable of shape-shifting, I already said that, but disguising themselves as ordinary human beings, even. So there's been a lot of academic work you can look into that has specifically examined the way Lansdale's campaign sort of exploited this already existing body of folklore rather than just inventing a brand new creature feature to be afraid of. So all of this, in my opinion, makes this operation considerably more interesting. Lansdale's people didn't just have to convince anybody that monsters existed. They only had to essentially change that monster's address. And the Oswang now lived on that hill that the Hook insurgency was living on as well. And that was the message. Lansdale goes on to say that they basically just went about their business for the next few days and let this rumor circulate amongst the people and across the countryside. This is probably one of the most psychologically important parts of the entire operation, because if there had just been this random corpse that appeared first, it would have simply just been a murdered man, and the guerrillas might have assumed that government troops had killed him. They might have searched for footprints or ambushers or military patrols, but Lansdale intentionally kept the military and the government out of the area. He wanted the rumor to be the only thing that was circulating and wandering amongst the foliage there. If it hadn't been that way, then the guerrillas' minds would have sort of begun, if you will, with ordinary explanations for what they were seeing already. So instead, the explanation for the phenomenon came first. The explanation that an Oswang, a vampire creature, is in their midst, and the evidence came later. The story was allowed to move organically through the population. A villager tells another villager. Somebody repeats that an unusual creature has been seen. Someone else remembered, an older story, a legend perhaps, a mythology, and then this warning that the creature is in the area becomes a rumor with horrifying memories of stories told as children, and that story and that rumor becomes something supposedly heard from somebody who knows somebody who actually witnessed it, and then every time you have to go out to the jungle to take a leak, there's just a little bit more horror involved. And eventually, the idea reached the gorillas on the hill. And nothing supernatural has occurred, but the psychological environment has already changed in the region. There is an Aswang here. Now every unexplained sound in the vegetation has a completely different possible explanation. Now somebody wakes during the night because he thought he heard movement or something on the roof. Now when a dog behaves strangely, it's perhaps due to a spiritual vision or encounter. And when a man disappears temporarily from sight, there's something else going on. The forest itself hasn't changed, but the way that the forest is being interpreted has. And only after allowing this whole concept, this idea, to settle into the population and into the jungle did the combat psychological warfare team move to the second phase of the operation. According to Lansdale, they learned the route that was used by Hook patrols moving along the hill, and they positioned themselves beside the trail at night. Now, it's a common misconception that perhaps it was CIA operatives themselves doing this mission, this part of the mission. If you do some digging, it does appear that it's more like Filipino commandos that are doing the mission for the CIA. But they just basically waited to ambush a Hook patrol. And this Hook patrol, it eventually came down the trail in a column, single file. They allowed the gorillas to pass, and when the final man in the patrol reached them, the hidden operators seized him. They kidnapped him, and they did this under the cover of darkness. So the men ahead just continued walking, not realizing that one of their own had been taken. And nobody heard anything. Nobody saw anything. A man simply went missing in the dark. And this was sure to cause a parabolic reaction psychologically as well, as I'm sure you can imagine. There hadn't been a firefight. There was no scream in the darkness. Simply a disappearing comrade in an environment that was filled with stories currently of an Aswang wandering around, killing children, shape-shifting, committing atrocious vampiric acts upon the local populace. And the Hook were none the wiser, because this is a deeply entrenched belief within their spiritual system. Then came the part that transformed the operation from propaganda into something much more disturbing. According to Lansdale, the captured gorilla was killed. Two punctures were made in his neck, vampire style, he said. And the body was then suspended upside down by the heels and drained of blood before being returned to the trail where the gorillas would eventually find their comrade. Lansdale explicitly described the wounds as being made in a vampire-like fashion. So consider what the team had created here. There was this pre-existing cultural mythology. There was the geographically specific rumor that they had circulated. And then there was the mysterious disappearance of their comrade. And now there was a corpse constructed to conform to the story that they had spread throughout the area. Now the body was no longer just the remains of a dead insurgent. It had been turned into physical propaganda. Even the method by which the man disappeared from the patrol was all part of the performance. The psychological warfare team had effectively created an artificial paranormal encounter. When the guerrillas discovered that their comrade was missing and retraced their route, They reportedly found him lying along the trail with the strange wounds in his neck and his body apparently drained of blood. And now the sequence became so psychologically powerful because the evidence was confirming something that they had heard about before the death even occurred. The Oswong was here. The rumor had predicted the corpse, and that is extraordinarily different from inventing the story afterward. Imagine the conversation among these insurgents. They had all heard the stories, they had all recalled the legend, and they had all listened to the surrounding peasants and the people living in the jungles of this area. They had all heard what was going on because they're very in tune with the place that they're in. That's part of their whole shtick. That's part of why they are so hard to defeat. And now, all they had to do was believe their own eyes. According to Lansdale, that's exactly what they did. He claimed that the guerrillas concluded that the Oswong had actually killed their companion, and they feared another attack so badly that by daylight, he wrote in his book, the Hook Squadron had completely abandoned the area. And this is what makes the incident more disturbing than the simplified version in which people say the CIA pretended to be a vampire. The monster was almost incidental. The real weapon was the confirmation of the monster. First, they create an expectation, and then they create an event that seems absolutely inexplicable. Then they provide evidence that fits the expectation that the people they are trying to manipulate already have. The victim completes the story himself. The psychological warfare team, they didn't have to stand in the jungle wearing costumes pretending to be creatures. They didn't have to convince hundreds of people through any elaborate propaganda. They just inserted one idea into an already existing cultural framework and then engineered reality so that subsequent events appeared to validate it. This is why sometimes I second guess all of the alien talk in the media. This is why I often don't believe the first things I hear when it comes to disclosure. This is often why I look twice at the Miami Mall incident when allegedly aliens were there and all those police showed up. Remember that a few years ago? This is why all of those types of things really make me, instead of, you know, lunge headlong into the story and how I can validate it, make me step back and be like, what's really going on here? Because if people step back and just look at the big picture for a second, realizing what's already going on in the world around them, sometimes you can tell what's going on a little bit better than, and you know, it makes a little bit more sense too than trying to actually confirm that the monster is real. Just something to chew on there. Pardon the pun. These agencies know that your stories and your folklore can become weapons against you, and that opens a pretty uncomfortable door. For instance, there's something fascinating about this operation that I think is pretty easy to overlook, and that's the concept that the Hook guerrillas maybe knew it was fake. What if none of them actually genuinely believed that a supernatural vampire had descended upon their camp? What if they understood perfectly well that human beings had done this, and this is how crazy the enemy is, their enemy, in this case, the CIA operators? Does that mean the psychological operation failed? No, it still works, because imagine discovering the body of your friend in the darkness, and his neck has been punctured, and his blood has been drained, and somebody has intentionally arranged him to resemble the victim of a monster that your culture has been talking about for generations. Even if you immediately think to yourself, this isn't an Oswong, your next thought becomes something else. And that's that somebody did this deliberately. And now you know something about your enemy. You know that whoever you're fighting is willing to abduct a man silently from the back of a patrol, kill him, drain his blood, and stage his corpse purely to horrify you. And at that point, whether the vampire is real almost becomes irrelevant. There's still a monster in the jungle. It simply has a government payroll. Dang, I'm glad they're on our side, right, boys? And that's why one of my favorite observations about the entire affair came from Wendigoon, who is a great YouTuber, check him out, who essentially pointed out that whether it was an actual supernatural creature or the CIA, considering the result was the same, you should probably be scared. And really, what is scarier, a vampire attack by an actual cryptid or a covert organization willing to fake one? Because if there is an unimaginably powerful organization capable of literally appearing out of nowhere, abducting people in darkness, killing them, draining their blood, using this terror produced by that act to manipulate an entire population, by the way, at some point we are arguing semantics over what qualifies as a monster. And apparently the Oswang operation was not just an isolated flash of creativity from former advertiser Lansdale. Him and the people around him continued to study Filipino beliefs almost like the advertisers would if they were to study a target demographic for sales. William Bloom described Lansdale's team examining further superstitions, taboos, and myths and folklore of the people living in Hook territory. And they were searching for vulnerabilities, any other vulnerabilities within the spirituality that could be converted into psychological pressure. Think about what that means in the modern context. You know, in this case, a military intelligence apparatus was treating folklore as actionable intelligence. I think we live in a time now where folklore and sci-fi concepts and cryptid stories and alien stories and UFO, you know, all this kind of stuff, it's very much at the forefront. I mean, this current administration is pushing this stuff relentlessly.
John Daly here. You know what day it is? Neither do I. I live life daily. That's why I only spin on Moto Casino. Moto's got daily free bonuses, daily tournaments, new slots added daily. And the best part? Guaranteed daily jackpots. You can't beat that. So today's the day you grip it and spin it with me on Moto, America's social casino. Play for free on Moto.us.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details. Download the Moto Casino app today. Must be 21 plus.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
So I feel like we're primed for any number of psychological pressures of a spiritual, folkloric type. Maybe that's just me, but these stories become vulnerabilities, superstitions. They become the pressure points that are used, and traditions then become mechanisms through which human behavior could potentially be altered. And there's another story that comes out of Lansdale's legends here of just this occurring. One reported tactic involved aircraft flying over Hook-controlled areas, broadcasting these mysterious curses in Tagalog toward villagers who assisted the guerrillas. And the idea was basically to frighten communities away from providing support. Another technique became known as the Eye of God, and the basic concept had roots in earlier psychological warfare. It's actually an ancient form of psychological warfare, but one specific time was during the Second World War when enemy officers could hear their own names being broadcasted over loudspeakers, along with threats that they would be the next to die. Pretty horrifying. And Lansdale essentially adapted that same principle. Instead of just threatening individuals, his people painted a strange symbol outside the homes of suspected Hook sympathizers. And the symbol was an eye. Imagine waking up in your village, already consumed by fear in your war-torn country, and discovering some strange symbol painted outside your home or on your wall or on your door. With no explanation, no visible perpetrator, just an eye. And you don't really know who painted it there. You don't know why it's there. You don't know who's been watching, but you assume, since it's an eye, that it does mean you are being watched. You don't know what they're watching or how much they know about what you've done. You don't even really know why you're being watched. You only understand the implication that they see you. Lansdale described the mysterious appearance of these malevolent eyes as having a pretty sharply sobering effect, he said. And again, notice what's happening here. The weapon is not the paint. The weapon is the human mind attempting to interpret the paint. That is the recurring principle behind all of this. Psychological warfare doesn't necessarily need to convince you of one specific thing. Sometimes it only needs to create enough uncertainty that your own imagination begins to do all the legwork. You work against yourself. And then there's another story here, which is just as weird and creepy as the first one, except this one comes with sound effects. Vietnam gave us one of the most bizarre examples of this same type of concept ever attempted, at least that we know about and that has been documented. It's Operation Wandering Soul. I want you to imagine for a second being a Viet Cong soldier somewhere in the jungle at night, and you're exhausted, you're surrounded by darkness, you've undoubtedly lost friends in horrific ways, you've seen their bodies torn to pieces by relentless and horrifying war machines. The Vietnam War was a nightmare, an absolute nightmare that it seems very few talk about in full detail. War is hell, and it savagely reconstructs the way that you see the world around you and the things that you believe in. Your mind becomes populated with brutal thoughts as you witness the true evil, the true limit of the human, what they're capable of, what they're willing to do, and how much they can take. Maybe some of your friends died without being properly buried. They're still lying out there in the jungle somewhere on the sands. And then somewhere beyond the trees, you begin hearing something. And it's faint at first. You can't see anyone, but you hear a voice. And it seems to eerily move through the jungle. The voice turns to screams, and then there's moans and wailing. And then the voice begins speaking, and it claims to belong to a dead man. During the Vietnam War, the U.S. Army's 6th Psychological Operations Battalion, working with the U.S. Navy and South Vietnamese participants, created these disturbing audio recordings that you're hearing now that became associated with what was called Ghost Tape Number 10. And the recordings exploited beliefs surrounding the spirits of people who died without receiving proper burial. Now, within those beliefs, a person who died improperly and whose remains were not dealt with according to tradition might become a wandering soul, a spirit that's unable to find any peace. So American psychological warfare specialists, well, they created one, a spirit unable to find peace, and they kept doing it. But these weren't real spirits, they were technological ones. So they recorded voices portraying dead Viet Cong soldiers supposedly speaking from beyond the grave. And there were shrieks and screams surrounding the voices. This manipulation, this psychological warfare, wasn't only intended to scare people out of their, you know, their bunkers or something like that. These dead men in these tapes warned their living comrades. They begged them not to share the same fate, to die and be left unburied as wandering souls. They told them to go home. And helicopters carrying loudspeakers flew through the darkness, broadcasting these voices across the jungle. Other speakers were positioned on the ground, hidden inside the jungle, so that the sound could seemingly appear from different locations. The forest itself became haunted. And some enemy soldiers apparently recognized the deception and fired toward the helicopters carrying the speakers, but others were reportedly frightened by it. But again, I'm not convinced that disbelief makes the operation meaningless. Imagine knowing the Americans are somewhere beyond the darkness, intentionally broadcasting the voices of your dead friends. Imagine hearing screams drifting through the jungle for hours, knowing perfectly well that a speaker is producing them. The human nervous system, it doesn't suddenly become immune to horror because the conscious mind understands the mechanics behind it. You know the horror movie isn't real. You still feel your heart beating faster and you might walk down your dark hallway a little quicker at night or maybe not want to spend as much time outside near the chicken coop after dark. You know the thing moving in the haunted house is an actor. But your body still reacts when it comes around the corner. Rational knowledge and instinctive fear can actually occupy the same human being simultaneously. And psychological warfare exploits that. It lives inside that gap. And Operation Wandering Soul reportedly went even further. There was a time that a rumor was spread that a tiger had begun attacking enemy troops. So the psychological warfare unit added recordings of tiger growls, and according to one account, the tactic frightened as many as 150 men from a mountain position. And by the way, that tiger story kind of reminds me of the whole tick situation in the USA right now, how everybody has been sort of programmed to fear the outside because of ticks. And listen, I know that ticks are, you know, they can carry Lyme disease, they can carry diseases. I understand. I know people who have had Lyme disease and all this kind of stuff. I get it, you know, like ticks suck and stuff. I've been around and had a lot of ticks on me throughout my whole life, growing up where I grew up and how I am primarily outside whenever I get the opportunity to be. But I definitely, throughout this year, went from being very afraid of this little bug to now having spent a lot of time outdoors and not really finding a reason to fear the tick, whether the case is that I'm just not getting as many ticks as they said I was going to get, or, you know, they're not really posing a threat to me, or whatever the case may be. It's probably different, you know, based on where you are, but this all brought me to the question of whether or not this was a psychological operation in of itself, kind of like the whole mask thing was, that essentially isolated Americans from each other. Even though now the 6-foot rule has disappeared, we are still not the same as we were pre-COVID. We are still very much untrusting of our neighbors and the people around us, similar to how it feels like we're being programmed to be untrusting of the entire outside world as at this point, you know. And at the same time, they're unrolling all the surveillance and the flock cameras and the drone stuff and everything. And it's kind of like there is this push to make outside look scarier than it is, just like this tiger, just like these ghosts, just like these vampires and Oswangs, you know. This is where the story becomes much larger than these cryptids and these spirits and these tigers and these bugs, because none of these operations actually required the United States government to believe in these things. They didn't have to believe in vampires or ghosts or wandering souls or giant ravenous tigers. They only had to know and understand that somebody else did believe in these things. And that is an extremely important distinction. A government doesn't have to prove that the supernatural exists. Nobody does, by the way. This isn't just government. But they don't have to believe that the supernatural exists in order to weaponize the supernatural. Your fellow conspiracy theorists can do this to each other. You know, if you have a big podcaster out here who is really pushing an agenda, he's doing the same thing. He is weaponizing the supernatural and committing an act of psychological warfare upon his fellow man. The greatest weapon is just understanding what people believe about that supernatural thing. And through that understanding and that ability to utilize that weapon, you can cause catastrophic results. So, in all this sense, mythology becomes the terrain. Just as a military strategist, for instance, studies mountains, rivers, roads, and, you know, weather, stuff like this, where bridges are, etc., psychological warfare can study folklore and religion, your taboos and symbols and nightmares, and the culturally inherited architecture of fear, and what people in a demographic fear, in an area fear. The battlefield is inside the mind, people. And once that happens, the distinction between reality and mythology, it becomes very, very, very unimportant. Because psychological warfare is not necessarily attempting to change what is physically real. It's attempting to change the behavior of a person. If a man abandons a hill because he believes that there's a vampire on it, then the vampire has produced a real military effect. If a village stops helping insurgents because mysterious curses and eyes are being painted on their doors, then they're probably, that's going to have a real military effect. They're going to stop supporting the insurgents. If soldiers flee a position because they hear their dead friends calling out to them from the jungle, those ghosts have produced a real military effect. The entity doesn't need to exist. If aliens appear in a mall and nobody's around to record it, but there's a lot of people saying they were there and potentially saw something, and all the police showed up, so something must have happened, and there was something on the camera, but we don't really know what it was, it has a real psychological effect on a population.
10 hours on my feet, traffic, noise, everybody needing something from me. My head is spinning. I just need the world to stop for 1 second. But then I get home, shoes off, phone out, and I open Modo Casino. Hundreds of slots, classic table games. It's my instant reset. The variety I want in the quiet I need.
Modo Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Modo.us for more details. Download the Modo Casino app today. Must be 21 plus.
Modo Casino. America's social casino.
The entity does not need to exist, in other words. The consequence does. The consequence is based on the belief in the entity, and that what happened must have happened because I believe in the entity. That's the strangest thing about this whole thing. We normally think of monsters as stories that human beings invented because they were afraid, some sort of ancient, evolved thing that's inside us, but in these situations, the relationship becomes almost inverted. Now human beings are inventing monsters because they understand how afraid other human beings can become of monsters. The monster stops being the product of fear. The fear becomes the product, and the monster becomes the weapon used to manufacture that. It's crazy how the spirit realm can be used as a battlefield. And there's another uncomfortable implication here. Once a government has demonstrated that it is willing to study supernatural belief for military advantage, we're forced to ask where that boundary actually ends, right? Not because every ghost story becomes a government operation. Obviously not. That's insane to say. And, it, you know, like when your grandma says, you know, I saw your grandpa last night in the corner, she's not a victim of a government operation. And I'm also not saying that every cryptid sighting is like psychological warfare. People who go out to the national parks and they say they see something, I'm not saying that you're like not experiencing that, and that what you're actually seeing are Filipino commandos or something in the forest trying to convince you that they're Bigfoot. All of that would be absurd. I'm more saying that history gives us these documented reasons to understand that intelligence organizations have, at least sometimes, been interested in the psychological usefulness of monsters and spirits and supernatural beliefs and omens and curses and all that kind of stuff. And that changes the way that I think we have to think about certain things. Imagine encountering something strange during a military conflict, seeing something in the woods, outside your position at night. You know, maybe you receive a strange symbol or message and you hear what sounds like the voice of somebody who died days earlier. There's now at least three possibilities competing inside your mind. Either you imagined it, something actually inexplicable happened, or somebody wants you to experience exactly what you experienced. And that is the one, that third one is the most psychologically devastating, I think, because it introduces a level of uncertainty into absolutely everything. I said it in one of my previous episodes. If you control a man's God by inventing religion, you control the man. And the man believes that he's living in a spiritual existence with a God, but that God has been manufactured by religion, okay? I obviously believe there is a God, but I'm saying that this can be manipulated through religion and through government and through control. And just like a man can be controlled through an invented God, a man can be controlled through invented monsters. Monsters that may be real, but in this case are not. That's the most sophisticated psychological weapon of all, I think. It's an altering of reality. It's not convincing you that these things are real or that they're fake. It's destroying your ability to know the difference, because then reality itself becomes uncertain. Then you really are living in a sort of a simulation, you know? You have this paranoia that becomes self-sustaining. What's real? What's not? Is this guy my friend? Is he not? Is this guy got the sickness or does he not? Is this actually Bigfoot or is it something else? Are the aliens on our side or are they not even real? And everything becomes manipulable. And through that, you become like, you know, you become like putty in their hands, essentially. They've colonized your imagination at this point, and that imagination follows you everywhere. So there you go. Hope you guys thought this was interesting. I certainly did. I love reading about this type of stuff. It's always so weird. But go outside, touch some grass, maybe get a tick or two, and in case I don't see ya, good afternoon, good evening, and good night.
Here's golf legend John Daly.
Hell yeah, these wins are piling up faster than my divorces.
I only spent on Moto, America's social casino. You know, I've won a couple of majors. And on Moto, I've won majors, grands, and epic jackpots on their classic Vegas slots with huge, huge bonus rounds. Moto Casino adds new games and awards players free coins every single day. Grip it and spin it on Moto Casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited, no purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.